Hi, Keri Phillips here, and thanks for downloading this Rear Vision podcast. Donald Trump, Nigel Farage, Bernie Sanders. Even if you think they're dangerous lunatics, populists threatening the future of democracy, you must admit they've certainly shaken up the political scene. Today you'll meet another, the man who next Saturday, to the surprise of many, may well be the leader of Britain's Labour Party, Jeremy Corbyn.
Well, we're offering hope, we're offering optimism, we're offering an alternative economic policy, we're offering a future which doesn't make this country more and more divided, where a minority of the super rich continue getting even richer and there are people sleeping on the streets. What we're looking at is a coherent, cohesive, decent society, and that's exciting.
An old-school socialist who wants to renationalise the railways, abolish uni fees and reverse Britain's welfare cuts is almost certain to become the next leader of the British Labour Party. Jeremy Corbyn squeaked onto the ballot with minutes to spare, but has since galvanised voters apparently hungry for a candidate with genuine conviction rather than polished spin. He's up against three other candidates who adhere to the new Labour formula that brought Tony Blair to power in 1997. John Curtis is a political scientist from the University of Strathclyde.
There are four people standing for the leadership of the Labour Party, and they pretty much can be aligned very clearly on the ideological spectrum from left to right. So the candidate who is clearly most Blairite, the candidate who, for example, says that Labour should go further in terms of using the private sector in order to deliver public services if that proves to be more effective, certainly competition for the delivery of public services, Liz Kendall. Then we have Yvette Cooper, who was in Gordon Brown's government, was the Shadow Justice Secretary. She is, again, not so Blairite as Liz Kendall, but certainly somebody who is willing, for example, to say that perhaps the Labour Party didn't always run the economy as effectively as it should have done under the last Labour government, but is accepting that certainly, therefore, Labour has to demonstrate its economic credibility. Then slightly further to the left of her is Andy Burnham, who actually stood in the 2010 election and didn't do terribly well, trying to stand as the unity candidate, saying that, well, you know, actually, yes, we do need to have a different message from the Conservatives, though maybe at the same time, maybe we also do need to be able to do that in a way that's economically responsible. But then, the man who's outpacing all of them, Jeremy Corbyn.
Dr. Jonathan Hopkin is Associate Professor of Comparative Politics at the London School of Economics. I spoke to him by Skype.
Well, Jeremy Corbyn is a self-proclaimed, self-identifying socialist, which wouldn't have been such a strange thing for a Labour MP to be 30 years ago. But of course, since the experience of the Thatcher years being out of power for so long and then Tony Blair coming along and creating new Labour, this idea of Labour no longer being a party of the left but a party of the centre, appealing to broad areas of British society, even people who have no sympathy with socialist ideas, Jeremy Corbyn never signed up to that programme. He's always been a thorn in the side of the Blairites and has stuck to very, very coherent left-wing positions on a whole range of issues.
What does left and right, or left and right wing, mean in the context of British politics and in particular, I suppose, British Labour Party politics?
Traditionally, the Labour Party was a party that was close to the trade unions, which was backing the working class, so to speak, against employers, that was on the side of working people, that was in favour of the welfare state, of workers' rights, and generally not that enthusiastic about free markets. Now, of course, with the changes in the world economy in the 80s and 90s, and the changes, especially in countries like Britain, where we moved very strongly towards a free market model, a very American type of model of economy, the Labour Party initially opposed those moves and then by the 90s reconciled themselves to, you know, free market economics. People on the left of the Labour Party have always been very hesitant to accept that. They've always been much more favourable to greater government involvement in the economy. They've always been more favourable to redistribution of income and wealth, to a strong welfare state, even at the expense of higher taxes. And also in foreign policy, it tends to mean less close adherence to NATO, to American foreign policy. So these are the kind of issues where a figure like Corbyn stands out as being on the left of the Labour Party.
Well, Jeremy is an old leftist. He was first elected to Parliament in 1983. And he's not changed his opinions in any way over the years.
Dr. Richard Heffernan, a reader in politics at the Open University, is astonished at the meteoric rise of Jeremy Corbyn.
If you'd said to me 4 months ago that Jeremy Corbyn would be the leader of the Labour Party, I would have bet my house, my pension and both kidneys on the fact that that was not a possibility. He's come completely from nowhere. His policies are collectivist. He believes in the regulated market. He believes in high taxation. He believes in nationalisation of industry. He believes in the planned economy. But he's really running and getting a great deal of support against austerity. As you know, we have a sovereign debt crisis here. We have a large public sector debt. And the Conservative government and the previous Conservative-led coalition is committed to damping down this debt by public sector cuts in expenditure, reductions in welfare, and so on. And Corbyn is against that completely. And the other three candidates are all in some way associated with believing that Labour must too damp down the deficit and must engage in austerity measures of a smaller and shorter kind than the Conservatives are proposing. So you can see there's a difference of opinion between Jeremy and the two or three other candidates. It's also worth noting that the support for Jeremy is also a rejection of the three other candidates, all of whom are career politicians who've been in government and been in parliament and been in Labour politics since they left university. They all work very closely with patrons in the former Labour government. They're all not particularly first-rate politicians, in my opinion, but don't attract much support within the Labour Party. And so, for instance, if Jeremy Corbyn is addressing a rally of 2,000 people, you'll find Yvette Cooper speaking to a private members' meeting of some 60 people.
How did such an unreconstructed leftist get onto the ballot in the first place? Candidates must first be nominated by a number of fellow Labour MPs. Anne Trenerman is the parliamentary sketch writer for The Times in London.
You have to have a certain number of sponsors to get on the ballot. And what happened was quite a few MPs who were actually supporting other candidates decided that they wanted to, quote unquote, widen the debate. And so the way to widen the debate beyond Andy, Liz and Yvette was to get Jeremy in there. And I think some of Andy Burnham's supporters thought this is a way to make Andy look less left-wing. So if you get Jeremy in there, you get a real left-winger in there, then Andy doesn't look so left. And so that makes Andy more electable. This was the concept. Anyway, of course, it's spectacularly boomeranged on them. So they've supported him, saying that they were supporting him not to win, but to be in the contest. Since then, I think some of the people have admitted that they are, quote-unquote, morons for having done that.
This leadership election is being held using a different system from the way in which Ed Miliband was elected in 2010. Why? Because there was a row during Ed Miliband's leadership about this method, in particular about the idea of trade unions having as much influence within the party as they did, and that in particular, anybody who is a member of a trade union's affiliated Labour Party could indeed end up having a say in candidates being selected as MPs and certainly in the leadership of the Labour Party. And in the back of that, Ed Miliband said, right, we really need as a party to move to one member, one vote. Now, the trade unions weren't completely excluded. What the trade unions were told is, well, look, you know, if you want people to be able to vote in an election, you've got to get them to sign up as individuals to say they really are supporters of the Labour Party. The other thing that was done was to say, well, actually, you know, we want to widen up this electorate. This, after all, had been the vision that many people in the Labour Party felt, is that, you know, we need to widen our base, get more people involved in elections. And so it's also true that around 120,000 people have been registered for this election simply on the basis of paying £3 and saying to the party, I support the party. So they've not become members, but they are signed up as supporters. But what we've discovered is that this new version of running the election looks as though, contrary to the expectations of many of those who have been advocating it, looks as though it's played into the hands of the left. partly in truth, because what looks as though has happened is that since 2010, under Ed Miliband's leadership, those who are full members of the Labour Party have rather changed their character. And that in perhaps probably particularly under Ed Miliband's leadership, some of those who left the party in the wake of Iraq, disenchantment with New Labour, have filtered back into the party, and they were always rather more on the left. Certainly also the trade unions, they're backing Jeremy Corbyn, they like his ideas, and that certainly looks therefore as a result that the people they've signed up are going to back Mr. Corbyn. Now, the fact, however, that Mr. Corbyn is doing as well as he is not just simply a reflection of his own qualities. And the crucial essential quality he seems to have, for those at least who are backing him, is what we might call authenticity. In other words, he's saying, look, I am telling you what I believe. I'm not telling you what I think is electorally useful. And I'm certainly not telling you what's gone through the mincemeat of a spin doctor. Whereas one of the things that have become associated with New Labour is the idea that everything goes through a spin doctor. Nobody ever gives you a straight answer to a question, etc., etc.
First of all, you have to remember that the Labour Party has gone through a long process of adapting to a type of politics which in the end isn't really very much in the Labour tradition. It's meant signing up to policies that many people in the Labour movement didn't like, such as part privatisation of the National Health Service, cuts to welfare benefits for some of the poorest people in society, an approach to the financial system which has allowed the banks to make an awful lot of money and then create huge economic problems. I think there's been a pent-up frustration in many parts of the Labour movement at the way the Labour Party has accepted many things that a lot of Labour supporters really strongly disagree with. I think in the context of the financial crisis, the recession we're going through, and then the dismal Labour performance in the last election, all of this has created a scenario where a left candidate could do well.
In Australia, party leaders are elected by their fellow MPs. The British Labour Party, after its loss in the 2010 elections, adopted an unusual arrangement where anyone can pay £3, sign up as a party supporter, and vote for the leader. It's fueled rumours that Conservatives might sign up in big numbers and vote for Corbyn to undermine the party, or that even more extreme leftists might do the same and drag the party in their direction. But is there any evidence of such skullduggery?
Yes, that is a popular story. I mean, we have no evidence for it. About 600,000 people are now eligible to vote in the leadership election. And a sizable number of those are people who've identified themselves as supporters. If you identify as a supporter of the Labour Party and you pay £3, you get a vote in the election. And some suggestions are, there was, for example, a mischievous campaign by Conservative supporters to register themselves to vote for Jeremy Corbyn as the least electorally friendly of the candidates. And when they were asked, why are you joining, they said to consign the Labour Party to oblivion. But that's a small number of people. About 1,000, 1,500 people have been weeded out, and perhaps some more. For the most part, it's individual people of a left-leaning disposition who may have voted Labour or may have voted to parties to the left of Labour, the Greens, for example. These now are said to be joining to support Jeremy Corbyn. So there probably is a groundswell. But it's generally not, in my opinion, although we wait to see the evidence, there's not much skullduggery. It's mostly individual people of a leftist disposition joining the Labour Party to vote for a leftist candidate. It's not organised in any way, shape or form. It's not. There's no group to the left of Labour sending its members into the party. It's individual people joining on the basis of individual decisions.
This is Rear Vision with Keri Phillips on RN. You can also hear us wherever and whenever you want with the ABC Radio app, free at Google Play and Apple's App Store. Today we're hearing about the election of a new leader for Britain's Labour Party, where a surge of popular support for a 66-year-old vegetarian teetotaler has surprised everyone, including former leaders of his own party.
Labour grandees are lining up to urge the party faithful not to vote for a man who wants to take the UK out of NATO, renationalise the railways and reopen some coal mines. Cue former Prime Minister Gordon Brown.
I'm not here to attack any individual candidate. What I'm here to say is that the best way of realising our high ideals is to show that we have an alternative in government that is credible, is radical and is electable. is neither a pale imitation of what the Tories offer, nor is it the route to being a party of permanent protest rather than a party of government.
In recent weeks, many of the old party leaders, Blair, Brown, Mandelson, even Neil Kinnock, have come out publicly and warned people against voting for Corbyn and suggesting that it will mean the annihilation of the Labour Party if he gets to lead it. Can you tell us something about that? That all sounds a bit hysterical.
Well, I suppose you need to remember what the Labour Party went through. Between 1979 and 1997, the party was out of power for 18 years. It lost four successive elections. It was a hugely traumatic experience. Neil Kinnock was the man who took over in 1983 after Labour's worst ever defeat, slightly worse than even its last defeat in 2010, and dragged the party over to what were considered more electable positions. Then, of course, Gordon Brown and Tony Blair took over the party after that and pushed the party even further to the centre and were ultimately successful in winning elections. So their view is very clearly that if the party lurches to the left, as it did in the 1980s, it can only lead to defeat. And, of course, defeat means Conservative government for the foreseeable future, which Labour Party members themselves would not be happy about. On the other hand, I think where they are misjudging the mood is that the world has changed. The kinds of Thatcherite policies that appeared new and fresh in the 1980s now appear old and stale to many, especially younger voters. And I think there's a momentum to actually bring about some kind of change. There is a revival on the left. Whether that's enough to win an election is another matter, but there's no doubt that there is a move on the left of British politics towards more combative opposition to Conservative policies than we've had in the past. And this is where the big split in the Labour Party between pragmatists, if you like, and the sort of more enthusiastic left-wingers comes about.
Labour last wrested power from the Conservatives in 1997, after almost two decades of radical Thatcherite economics had transformed Britain and forced the transformation of the Labour Party as well. It was a landslide victory for Labour. They won 418 seats, the most the party has ever held.
New Labour, New Britain, the party renewed, the country reborn, New Labour, New Britain.
We have changed. We were right to change. Parties that do not change die, and this party is a living movement, not an historical monument.
Tony Blair, initially both as leader of the opposition and as prime minister, was a remarkably popular politician, very charismatic figure, and he'd been able to appeal very widely across the electorate. But it began particularly to unravel in 2003, following his decision to join the United States in the invasion of Iraq on the basis of the claim that Saddam Hussein possessed weapons of mass destruction. The fact that those weapons of mass destruction were not found, the fact that indeed the situation in Iraq became pretty unstable thereafter, and given that this invasion, it had itself been controversial, it had split certain elements of the Labour Party, the sometime Foreign Secretary Robin Cook resigned over the issue amongst others, and certainly caused considerable disaffection within the membership of the Labour Party, meant that the glow that had been around Tony Blair began to disappear. The party, in truth, only won in 2005. Rather, luckily, the Conservatives had voted for the war, and if the Conservatives hadn't voted for the war, I think the truth is Tony Blair would have been out on his ear in 2003. But the truth is, I think the Labour Party was already terribly well aware by that time that Tony Blair, who might once have been an electoral asset, was becoming increasingly less of an asset. And certainly, of course, what was also true is that Gordon Brown had long had ambition to become Prime Minister. He'd expected to succeed Tony Blair at some point. And those who were sympathetic to Gordon Brown, and this was a party that may not have been divided ideologically, but it was certainly divided personnel-wise between those who were friends of Tony Blair and those who were friends of Gordon Brown. And there began to be moves to try to push Tony Blair out. And eventually in 2007, he accepted that he was going to leave, and he therefore, in truth, was leaving rather earlier than he had anticipated. Now, initially, Gordon Brown in 2007 became Prime Minister. Tony Blair gone, Labour became more popular. But then Gordon Brown seriously blew it because he allowed speculation to gather that he would hold an early general election because it looked as though Labour was ahead of the polls and he therefore could gain his own mandate. Then the polls turned against him. He changed his mind. And then the electorate fell out of love with Gordon Brown very, very rapidly. And the reputation of him as a rather indecisive, dithering prime minister took hold. And from that, the party never recovered. But of course, what's also true, the party then had the misfortune and the warning signs already been there to be in office when presiding over the financial crash of 2008. In those circumstances, the 2010 election ended up being a pretty serious and inevitable defeat. Labour was certainly out on their ear.
In the wake of Labour's defeat in 2010, a coalition government of Tories and Liberal Democrats took office, and Labour looked for a new leader to replace Gordon Brown. This leadership election, like the current one, had its surprises.
This year's Labour Party conference has been dominated by the leadership battle between David and Ed Miliband. For more than 2 years, the more high-profile Miliband was considered the leader-in-waiting, a prize stolen in the final stretch by his little brother.
Well, it was very strange, obviously, because two members of the same family running against each other gave this added kind of human dimension to it, which leadership elections usually lack. David Miliband represented Blairite tradition, if you like, a continuation of New Labour, a kind of safe pair of hands, quite a centrist position, very effective politician, very convincing, and very competent. Whereas Ed Miliband was a bit more of the outsider, although he'd been in government too under Tony Blair and Gordon Brown. But he was probably a slightly more radical candidate and tried to drag Labour over to a more critical stance on the way in which British capitalism works, especially criticising the financial sector, arguing timidly perhaps in favour of more redistribution of wealth from the very rich to everyone else. Ed Miliband won that battle very narrowly, but had some trouble winning over the party, and in particular had trouble winning over voters. He was not a very charismatic candidate and was very strongly attacked by the right-wing press in Britain, and ultimately failed pretty dismally in the last election.
Well, there's a lot of theories about this, and one of the theories is that he never really got to grips with the economic question, which is, why did it all go so phenomenally pear-shaped under a Labour government? People in the Labour Party would say it's really not because Gordon Brown built more schools, it's because, you know, there was a worldwide collapse. But on the other hand, George Osborne and David Cameron have a really honed message on that, which is that it was them. It was the Labour Party. They crashed the car. They are to blame. And they weren't very convincing on it. The other reason, in my opinion, is that Ed Miliband is just a little bit weird. And no one kind of got over that. You know, even his supporters were like, well, yeah, Ed's a little bit weird. Of course, in my opinion, most politicians are a little bit weird. But for Ed Miliband, that was something that he just couldn't quite get over. And he is quite an intellectual. He's not a really street smart politician. We're not talking major charisma here. And I just think that he could not transcend that. He could not get out of himself.
Friends, Britain needs a strong Labour Party. Britain needs a Labour Party that can rebuild after this defeat so we can have a government that stands up for working people again. And now it's time for someone else to take forward the leadership of this party. So I'm tendering my resignation, taking effect after this afternoon's commemoration of VE Day at the Cenotaph.
Ed Miliband resigned immediately after Labour's loss in the election. Opinion polls had suggested a close result, but in the end, voters deserted Labour for the Scottish National Party, the Conservatives and UKIP. The Tories won outright with 330 seats. Labour won 232, its lowest tally since 1987. What will Labour have to do to win office again?
I think that the truth is, to win an election, they have to have, well, obviously you have to have enough people to vote for you. And most people are somewhere in the centre. Most people vote, in the end, on economic issues. And not only economic issues, but their economic issues. I mean, there's been quite a lot of analysis of Labour. Who are they for? You know, the original working class is sort of not the same. The miners, that whole thing, it's changed so much since 1945 when they had, you know, their finest hour type of thing. And all of that's true. But I also think that there are a lot of people in Britain who do not agree with the Tory view of the world. And if Labour makes an effort and finds a way to talk to people, then a lot of people are willing to listen. You know, we had in this last election this sort of revolution in Scotland is the only word that we can use for it. Now, what I'm kind of interested in thinking about, what happens if that revolution hadn't happened? Would this whole process be happening quite at the same level? I do think that the Labour Party definitely made a strategic misjudgment, political judgment. They thought that the collapse of the Liberal Democrats would mean that those Lib Dem voters would come back to Labour because Labour was going slightly to the left. That actually didn't happen. So there's a lot going on in British politics. You know, UKIP got a lot of Labour voters, especially in the North and the Midlands. And I just think that a lot of it hasn't kind of settled down yet.
The electorate is so unaligned now. It's much more willing to shop around. It's much less likely to support the same party across elections. And the Labour coalition, the old Labour coalition, is dwindling. And Jeremy speaks to that in some way. You know, he's an old trade unionist. He's an old collectivist. And he speaks to that, but that's a small percentage of the population at large, even if it is a sizable part of the Labour community. So Labour, I think, like all parties, are struggling to make sense of a changing world in which, as I say, increasingly people vote for the UKIP, people vote for the Greens in Scotland, for the SNP, and the Liberal Democrats, of course, soared and then fell back to earth in both seats and vote share. So we're really navigating a world without maps, electors and politicians alike, and that's what's so interesting about the Corbyn phenomenon. Nobody saw it coming. It arrived like a tsunami, and we don't know what it will mean. We'll have to wait to see.
Whatever Mr. Corbyn's merits or demerits, the potential problem he will face is at the end of the day, his parliamentary colleagues will be reluctant to follow him. It does raise the question as to whether or not, as in the early 1980s, when Labour last had a left leader, some MPs decide to defect and try to form a new party, or they join the Liberal Democrats, or whatever. And that as a result, he will struggle to maintain party unity. That certainly will be the challenge to him. He's not perhaps said everything that could be as diplomatic as it could be on this front. He, for example, is saying, well, look, you know, if I become leader, I will expect the membership be pushing their MPs to back my ideas. Well, shall we say that is certainly red rag to a bull to many MPs, because the one thing that many MPs don't like is the idea that their membership will try to stop them from being their local Labour MP on the grounds that they aren't left-wing enough. That, again, is an old battle inside the Labour Party. So his party management will undoubtedly be a serious issue for him, and he is going to have to reach out. Now, on the other hand, he said, look, you know, I accept this is a party of all the talents, and I will want to have people of all the talents inside my shadow cabinet. His problem may be, however, is that many of the talents inside the Labour Party may just not be willing to join, and certainly some of the other candidates, such as Liz Kendall and Yvette Cooper, have indicated that they are very unlikely to serve in a Jeremy Corbyn leadership.
The really unpredictable thing is what happens next, because as many people have pointed out, I think quite rightly, he's not the kind of political figure that's cut out for leadership, because he's always been somebody shouting from the sidelines. So having to actually take responsibility, bring the party together around a new set of policies, is something which I'm not sure he's equipped to do. In some ways, I would be amazed if he actually made it through to the next election.
You mentioned that you're a member of the Labour Party, and I assume you'll be voting for the new leader. Have you made your mind up yet? And if not, what are your thoughts?
Well, I've been trying to make up my mind. I think I've come to a conclusion. It's been quite an agonising process. I have a lot of sympathy with a lot of the things Jeremy Corbyn is saying. I also have a lot of sympathy with the view that he can't win an election, and the priority for the Labour Party has to be to get into power, because it's no good having all the best ideas if you're in opposition. I would prefer there to be some kind of candidate in between, someone with a little bit of radicalism, but at the same time without the hostages to fortune that Jeremy Corbyn clearly has. Unfortunately, there doesn't seem to be a candidate like that on, on the list. My hope is that a more mainstream candidate, such as probably Yvette Cooper or Andy Burnham, would take on board some of the clear message coming from the members that there needs to be a more combative approach, there needs to be a return to some more traditional left-wing values, but to package that in a more acceptable, pragmatic and winnable way. Whether or not that is plausible is anyone's guess. My preference, I'm going to vote for Yvette Cooper first and Andy Burnham second and Jeremy Corbyn third. However, if Corbyn was going to lose, I would have probably voted for him, because I think the party membership wanted to send this message to the leadership.
Dr. Jonathan Hopkin from the London School of Economics. The other people you heard were Professor John Curtis from the University of Strathclyde, Dr. Richard Heffernan from the Open University, and Anne Trenneman, the parliamentary sketchwriter for the Times newspaper. The results of the election will be announced next Saturday. If you'd like to hear this program again or read a transcript, go to our website. Just search Rear Vision. Stephen Tilley is the sound engineer for Rear Vision today. Bye till next time from me, Keri Phillips.